This talk that I'm going to give is really more of a talk than it is a workshop. But it is not a repeat of a talk that I gave at a conference in Austin, Texas, several years ago, titled the same title and with something like the same outline. Part of the reason for that is that I don't listen to my own tapes. I don't have my old notes. I'm getting older and I can't remember what I talked about yesterday, much less what I talked about years ago. But I have heard people talk about that talk, and so I kind of know what you've said it was. And I don't really want to repeat that. So at any rate, we'll go in a slightly different direction. I will say this, and this does mirror what I said years ago in Austin. I don't know about you, but I, for one, was robbed. I went all the way through school thinking that I was actually getting an education. Silly me. I actually did well, brought home pretty good report cards, was always in the top 10% of my class. I made my way into college and discovered that I really didn't have to study in order to get A's and B's, and so didn't study, and I got A's and B's. And toward the end of my college career, I started to get sort of serious about some things that I was interested in, and had a few professors that I really liked a lot, and they encouraged me and told me that I was bright and I had a wonderful future, and so I continued in education. And to this day, I now have a string of letters after my name, if I were ever so pretentious as to list all of the degrees that I've accumulated, like Detrius through the years. And it was really only after I'd accumulated quite a string of letters after my name that I realized that I was dumber than a swamp stump. And that I really had not yet begun to learn. I realized, really, when I became a parent and started thinking about the education of my own children, that all of the best and the most wonderful things that could have been a part of my largesse, that should have been a part of my legacy in education, I'd never received. I didn't know the great poetry. I'd never read the great classics. I'd never tasted of the marvels of rich art and architecture. I really didn't know much at all about any of the inheritance of Western civilization. Everything that I knew about opera, I had learned from Mighty Mouse cartoons on Saturday mornings. Here I come to save the day. It means that Mighty Mouse is on the way. I really and truly thought that I was educated, only to discover that I had been robbed. All the things that I really love about the Western civilization and its rich inheritance, I've learned since I was in school. The wind was a torrent of darkness among the gusty trees. The moon was a ghostly galleon tossed upon cloudy seas. The road was a ribbon of moonlight over the purple moor, and the highwayman came riding, riding, riding. The highwayman came riding up to the old inn door. He had a French cocked hat on his forehead and a bunch of lace at his chin, a coat of claret velvet and a breeches of brown doeskin. They fitted with nary a wrinkle. His boots were up to the thigh. He rode with a jeweled twinkle. His pistol butts were a twinkle. His rapier hilt a twinkle under the jeweled sky. How come I never got that in school? Now, how come I never got, when the enemy comes in roaring like a flood, coveting the kingdom and hungering for blood, The Lord will raise a standard up and lead His people on. The Lord of hosts will go before, defeating every foe. Defeating every foe. For the Lord is our defense. Jesu defend us. For the Lord is our defense. Jesu defend. 1,000 fall on my left hand, 10,000 to the right. And yet He will defend us from the arrow in the night. Protect us from the terrors of the teeth of the devourer. Imbue us with Your Spirit, Lord. Encompass us with power. Encompass us with power. For the Lord is our defense. Jesu defend us. For the Lord is our defense. Jesu defend. Or, lo, east is east and west is west, and never the twain shall meet till earth and sky stand presently at God's great judgment seat. But there is neither east nor west, nor border, nor breed, nor birth. When two strong men stand face to face, though they come from the ends of the earth. Or half a league, half a league, half a league onward, all in the valley of death rode the 600. Forward the light brigade. Charge for the guns. Into the valley of death rode the 600. I don't know about you, but I didn't get any of that. I had a typing class. I actually had a computer class, which was obsolescent 15 minutes after I got out of it. Now, I never once was able to come out of a class stunned and inspired. History for me was dates and dead people. Music was something that I didn't, wouldn't ever listen to. Art appreciation was a series of fast-forwarded slides of dusty pedigree and of foolish remarks that missed the point entirely. I was robbed. And worst of all, I discovered that even with a string of letters after my name, worst of all, I did not know how to think. And I did not know how to learn how to learn. And so it was long after I was out of school that I actually began the process of learning. And that's not altogether a bad thing. The English novelist and etymologist J.R.R. Tolkien once told his students that all true education is actually a kind of never-ending story, a matter of continual beginnings, of habitual fresh starts, of persistent newness. Similarly, his good friend C.S. Lewis said that education is like a tantalizingly perpetual veranda, the initiation of unending beginnings. For me, I have discovered that my own education has been very much that, a series of new beginnings that I have dragged into my 30s and 40s and now into my 50s as I struggle to learn what I probably should have learned when I was young. To be sure, Peyton Randolph learned all of these things before he was 11, when he enrolled in the College of William and Mary. Patrick Henry was schooled in these things by the time he was 15, though he never had formal education and grew up a virtual pauper. I don't know about you, but I was robbed. This idea of perpetual new beginnings is a peculiar one, one that we don't really instill in our students, much less in ourselves. The fact is that this uniquely Christian perspective is an entirely alien worldview, an alien notion, an arcane paradox, an unfathomable mystery. Minds dulled by the smothering conformity of popular culture simply cannot plumb the depths or explore the breadths of a distinctively Christian virtue of hopeful contentment in the face of perpetual tasks. As a result, we rush toward what we think will be the termination of this or that or another chapter in our lives. We can't wait to finish school. Thus, for instance, graduation is never a commencement for us, but a conclusion. Afterwards, we hurry through our lives and careers. We plod impatiently through the week, waiting for the weekend. We bide our time until vacation and then plod on until retirement, always coming to the end of things until at last things come to an end. But within the Christian worldview framework, hopeful contentment in the face of never-ending responsibilities is a virtue that continually breeds in us a kind of anticipation for new beginnings, not old resolutions. It is a virtue that provokes us to a fresh confidence in the present as well as in the days yet to come. This is simply because it is a virtue rooted in an understanding of God's own good providence in the world and in the covenant fortunes of His grace. The fact is, we above all people should understand, we who were brought from death to life, who were brought from the end of ourselves to the threshold of eternity, we above all people should understand this. This is, in fact, the very essence of the gospel, isn't it? The crucifixion is not the termination of Christ's mediatorial work. Rather, it is the conjunction of two beginnings. The incarnation and the resurrection. It is the pivot of civilization, demarcating a new creation. The old things have passed away. Behold, all things have become new. As a result, as Christians, we ought to be the most optimistic of all people, forever starting afresh, affirming our faith in full accord with the patriarchs and patristics. Now, faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not yet seen. Thus, for example, all talk of education is for us a reminder that we've only just begun to learn how to learn. It's an affirmation that though our malignant heritage has introduced us to nonsense upon nonsense, while our media pours forth piffle, drivel, and swill, that we ought to be the heirs of a rich legacy of art and music and history and science and ideas in the past. And we've only just begun to taste them, just been introduced, and that a lifetime adventure in these vast and portentous arenas still actually awaits us. Indeed, the most valuable lessons that education can convey are invariably the lessons that never end. That's actually at the heart of the Christian philosophy of education. And why it is that what we're about at this conference cuts across the grain of so much of the rest of what we see in this poor fallen world. The Prince of the Preachers said, Charles Haddon Spurgeon once said, "I would have everybody able to read, write, and cipher." Indeed, he said, "Now, I don't think that a man can know too much. But mark you, the knowing of these things is not education. And there are millions of your reading and writing folk who are as ignorant as neighbor Norton's calf." Now, amazingly, the ignorant masses of whom Spurgeon now speaks are not those who failed to finish their lessons. They are instead those who did finish, or rather those who naively thought that lessons were the sorts of things that could be finished. Education does not have a terminus, a polar extreme, a finish line, an outcome. Instead, it is a deposit, an endowment, a promise, even a small taste of the future. Again, that is the root of the Christian philosophy of education, a philosophy that once provoked an unprecedented flowering in Western civilization and will again if we would but adhere to those principles once again. Problem is that we're in the midst of a kind of designer disaster that we have paid dearly for in modern American education. We have remarkable school buildings. We poured unprecedented sums into teacher training and programs. We have computer labs so that students can now go to high school and take 4 years of computer classes in order to learn Microsoft Word, which they could pick up in a half an hour at home, if only they would. Now, we have poured literally millions of dollars, billions of dollars into this juggernaut, and what do we have to show for it? A litany of woe. A litany of woe. Falling test scores. Falling so rapidly that SAT and ACT administrators have to actually jury-rig the numbers in order to maintain some sense of propriety. And still, the folly is maintained in our midst. In his introduction to John Henry Newman's brilliant The Idea of the University, the renowned educator Leo Brennan asserts that though we don't have much to show for it, we Americans are actually enthusiasts for education. And you know, he's actually right in a paradoxical and peculiar sort of way, though there may be a kind of underlying anti-intellectualism in a few circles. By and large, we Americans, particularly we American Christians, place a heavy emphasis on the education of our children. We demand good teachers. We demand good textbooks. We demand good facilities. We demand good supplemental resources. We demand the best and the latest and the snazziest of everything academia has to offer, which makes the profound lack of all of that, even within the Christian community, all the more ironic. The problem, Brennan says, is that we engage in the imminently dubious process of what is barbarously known as standardization. Now, as a result, he says, we lower our ideals and smear our philosophy by playing the sedulous ape to popular uniformitarian educational fads and fashions. In other words, what he's saying is that we have sold our soul to the devil of save the starving third world lesbian codependent whales, cultural diversity. But whatever happened to serious reading, classical content, familial superintendence, community, covenant, discipleship, mentoring, all essential aspects, defining characteristics of education in every age up until ours. They represent archaisms, long left in the dust of time by the newfangled doohickery and gadgetry of industrial contemporaneity and progressive modernity. Take reading, for example. Long before the bane of television invaded our every waking moment, and way before any of us could conceive of spending hours just Googling our lives away. C.S. Lewis commented that while most people in modern industrial cultures are at least marginally able to read, they just don't. In his wise and wonderful book, An Experiment in Criticism, he said, the majority, though they are sometimes frequent readers, do not set much store by reading. They turn to it as a last resource. They abandon it with alacrity as soon as any alternative pastime turns up. It's left for railway journeys, illnesses, odd moments of enforced solitude, or for that process called dismally reading oneself to sleep. They sometimes, he said, combine it with desultory conversation, often with listening to the radio, but literary people are always looking for leisure and silence in which to read and do so with their whole attention. When they are denied such attentive and undisturbed reading, even for a few days, they feel impoverished. He goes on, further admitting that there is a profound puzzlement on the part of the mass of the citizenry over the tastes and habits of the literate. He says, it is pretty clear that the majority, if they spoke without passion and were fully articulate, would not accuse us of liking the wrong books, but of making such a fuss about any books at all. We treat as a main ingredient in our well-being something to which for them is but marginal, hence to say simply that they like one thing and we like another is to leave out nearly the whole of the facts. I don't know about you, but I was never taught to love words, phrases, arguments. I was never taught to look at the architecture of the page, to listen to the rhythm and the ringing rhymes of the words as they danced and skittered across the page. I was never taught to listen to sounds and to feel the import and to go beyond the mere information transfer, the data that was there. And so it's no wonder at all that when I came across at Runnymede, what say the reeds at Runnymede? I thought to myself, I don't know. Or when I came across, why do they come? What do they seek? Who build but never read their Greek? Gone is the mild, the serene air. The golden years are come too late. Pursue not wisdom or virtue here, but what blind motivation, what dim last regret of men who slew their past, raised up this bribe against their fate. And I thought, huh? Because, you see, I was robbed. I was robbed of the notion that you could look at a room and understand a worldview. I was robbed. I was never taught that I could unfold a man's philosophy by looking at a series of his paintings. I was robbed when I was never told that I could penetrate the rhetoric and understand the purposes behind both Madison Avenue and Freud and Nietzsche and Marx and Engels. Now, all of this is not to imply any hint of moral turpitude on the part of modern bohemianism. Rather, it is simply to recognize the reality of the gaping chasm that exists between those who desire to have their lives come alive and those who are simply content to plod ever onward. And there's the rub. Fact is that most people want to have their cake and eat it too. A prospect that is as improbable as an Elvis sighting, a Beatles reunion, or a good piece of legislation coming out of Washington. See, the problem with real education is part and parcel with all of the other problems of modernity. See, things like serious reading and classical methodologies and engaged moms and dads and covenant communities that are woven together so that the fabric becomes the very warp and woof of our children's lives. The problem with all of that is that it actually requires the one thing that we moderns are most averse to. Work. Discipline. Accountability. And this odds to whom it may concern, instant everything, day of microwavable meals, prefab buildings, drive-through windows, no-wait credit approvals, broadband that irritates us if it wavers but for just a moment, and pre-digested formula entertainment, we tend to want to reduce everything to the level of the least common denominator and the fastest turnaround, which seems to be getting lower and lower and faster with every passing day. Even the church has fallen prey to this spirit of the times. If we really had our druthers, we wouldn't want worship to be too terribly demanding. We wouldn't want doctrinal challenges to our pet notions. We only want music that we're comfortable with. We only want preaching that reassures us. We only want those things which are quickly and easily digested. We want cheap grace, inspirational platitudes, bumper sticker ideology, easy faith. We want Christianity light. We want the nice news, not the good news. And so for the same reason, when we read, we really prefer literary junk food. The pre-digested factoids of USA Today are much easier to swallow than Cotton Mather's Magnalia Christi Americana. Let's face it, John Grisham and Danielle Steele and Tom Clancy and all of the rest are easier to digest than William Shakespeare and John Milton and G.K. Chesterton. Reading is a discipline. Learning is a discipline, and discipline is difficult. But of course, that's the way it is with anything that is actually worthwhile. In his remarkable book entitled The Moral Sense, James Q. Wilson drives home that point with great clarity. He makes the point that the best things in life invariably cost us something. We must sacrifice to attain them, to achieve them, to keep them, even to enjoy them. That's one of the most important lessons that we can learn in life. It's the message that we know that we ought to instill in our children. It's simply this: patience, commitment, diligence, constancy, delayed gratification will ultimately pay off if we're willing to wait long enough for the seeds that we have sown to sprout and bear. A flippant, shallow, and imprecise approach to anything, be it sports or academics or the trades or business or marriage, is ultimately self-defeating. It's not likely to satisfy any appetite, at least not for long. Now, you may be thinking to yourself, well, yeah, of course, this is obviously true, isn't it? Well, the fact is that all of the evidence points to the fact that such a notion is anything but obvious. I just look at the agenda items on any proposal for educational reform, whether it's secular or Christian, day schooling or homeschooling. You'll find recommendations on interactive media, computer software, technology enhancements, comprehensive correlative curricula, outcome-based objectives, trade affinity matrices, life skills development, and turnkey textual exercises. But nothing, or at least next to nothing, about Chaucer or Mandeville or Coleridge or Cervantes or Melville or Hawthorne or Longfellow or Wordsworth or Dickens or Twain or Warren, the brilliant men and women who wove together the fabric of Western civilization, knew absolutely nothing about correlative curricula or programmed outcomes or software enhancements, but they were educated and they could think. And we can't. They were educated in a way that we can only dream of today. Despite all of our nifty gadgets and gimmicks and bright ideas, they were steeped in Augustine and Dante and Plutarch and Vasari. They were conversant in the ideas of Seneca and Ptolemy and Virgil and Aristophanes. The notions of Athanasius and Chrysostom and Anselm and Bonaventure and Aquinas and Machiavelli, Abelard and Wycliffe. They had informed their thinking, shaped their worldview. Thus, they were able to preserve and then pass on to their progeny a heritage of real substance. So I was going through my educational career. I focused largely on American history. I was a political science major and an undergraduate, and I went on to study history and philosophy, primarily American history and philosophy, through the master's and the doctoral programs, and I thought I knew a thing or two. Now, much to my surprise, as I was gathering antiquarian resources as a young dad to prepare for the education of my own children, I had a shock when I realized that I didn't even know who the first president of the United States was. I mean, dumb me, I thought it was George Washington. I'd never actually done the math. When George Washington becomes the commander-in-chief of the armed forces of the new Continental Congress in 1775. There had already been a functioning, autonomous, independent government of the United Colonies for a year and a half prior to that. And then that government proceeded to work its way through a war with the world's greatest power. Over the course of the next 15 years, duly elected governments and duly elected presidents under three different constitutional charters, the last of them being the Articles of Confederation. And I realized that in all of my study and all of my advanced degrees, I didn't know anything about that period. I'd run across a couple of chapters on the Articles of Confederation in one class at one time, but I'd never actually read the Articles of Confederation. And so when I discovered that there were 16 presidential administrations prior to George Washington, I thought to myself, I've been robbed. Payne Randolph was the first president of the United States. Payne Randolph of Virginia. He was born in 1723. He died in 1775 after serving two terms as the president of Congress assembled. He was succeeded by Henry Middleton of South Carolina, who served for a year. He was succeeded by John Hancock, who inscribed his massive signature on the Declaration of Independence, not on July 4th, but on July 8th. I've been robbed. He was succeeded by Henry Lawrence of South Carolina. He was succeeded by John Jay, who later went on to found the American Bible Society. He was succeeded by Samuel Huntington, and he was succeeded by Thomas McKean, once the aide-de-camp of General Washington. And he was succeeded by John Hanson of Mulberry Grove in Maryland. And he was succeeded by Elias Boudinot of New Jersey, who co-founded the American Bible Society along with his dear friend John Jay, who later then became the first Supreme Court justice and the first leader of the litigation crew that forged America's first five treaties. He was succeeded by Thomas Mifflin of Pennsylvania. He was succeeded by Richard Henry Lee of Virginia, the patriarch of the Great Lees of Virginia. He was succeeded by Nathaniel Gorham of Massachusetts. He was succeeded by the only president of the United States ever born outside the United States, Arthur St. Clair, who was taught to hate the British following the great Battle of Culloden when his beloved Scots were defeated by the Duke of Cumberland and those despised Hanoverians from across the pond. He was succeeded by Cyrus Griffin, and I knew none of this stuff despite having advanced degrees in American history. I was robbed. I could tell you a few stories about Yorktown. I could tell you a few stories about Valley Forge. I even had a nifty photograph of George Washington kneeling in the snow on my desk. But I didn't know P, diddly, or squat about any of the rest of it. I was robbed. Supposing we know better than those who went before us, like Peyton Randolph, who by the age of 11 had read through the classical library of his father and grandfather, had mastered four languages, was admitted to William and Mary, and commenced immediately in order to keep up with his vast correspondence to teach himself how to write two different letters to two different people, at the same time, one with his right hand, one with his left hand, on two different subjects in two different languages, when he was 11. For those of us who cannot chew gum and walk at the same time, this is like a circus trick. We've been robbed. The amazing thing is that Peyton Randolph was not considered extraordinary. I love the story of Jacob Riis walking in to the governor's mansion in Albany, New York, to see Teddy Roosevelt, a recently returned hero from the Spanish-American War. They're sitting in a barber chair, receiving his morning shave and a haircut while dictating to five different secretaries simultaneously, one paragraph at a time. To one, he was dictating his a new biography of Oliver Cromwell. To another, he was dictating a speech that he would give later in the afternoon. To the third, he was dictating his plans for the upcoming legislative session. To another, he was dictating all of the plans for the parties that would take place over the next 2 days, welcoming the new staff to the governor's mansion. And to the final, he was dictating letters while simultaneously writing two different letters to two different people in two different languages, one with his right hand, one with his left hand, on a lap desk while getting a shave and a haircut. I've been robbed. Now, I don't expect to do circus tricks, but I would at least love to be able to think. I would love to be able to unravel the profundities of the past. Now, I have to tell you, as a young seminary graduate, when I came to, there is but one living God who is infinite in being and perfection, a most pure spirit, invisible, without body, parts, or passions, immutable, immense, eternal, incomprehensible, almighty, most holy, most wise, most free, most absolute, working all things according to the counsel of his own immutable and righteous will for his own glory, most loving, most gracious, merciful, long-suffering, abundant in goodness and truth, forgiving iniquity, transgression, and sin, the rewarder of them that diligently seek them, and withal most just and terrible in his judgments, hating all sin, and all who will by no means clear the guilty. I thought to myself, how am I ever going to completely understand that? Because I was robbed. As a young dad, I was absolutely determined as I made this startling discovery about my own foolishness that my children would at least get a taste of what I never got. The incomparable Dorothy Sayers once argued, well, somehow our whole approach to teaching and learning has gone awry. Do you sometimes have an uneasy suspicion that the product of modern educational methods is less good than he or she might be at disentangling fact from opinion and proven from the plausible? Although we often succeed in teaching our pupils subjects, we fail lamentably in the whole in teaching them how to think. They learn everything except the art of learning. This is why we do what we do. Because we know. We've caught a glimpse, if only from a distant past, over the horizon, we've caught a glimpse of what it is that we never got. A couple of weeks ago, I took my students with me to Cambridge, England, and we sat in King's College Chapel for Evensong. And so we were sitting there, these ethereal voices rising from the choir as they're gazing upward at unimaginable beauty and glory, where the rocks and stones themselves were crying out, "Hosannas to the King." One of my students leaned over and said, "And all these years, I thought you were exaggerating." He said, "I didn't think that it was possible to see anything like this or hear anything like this until heaven." What a sad indictment. That 500 years hence from the building of King's College Chapel, 500 years hence, this is the best we can do. And this is nice. That our children have no earthly idea what it is that God has called us to. We're still battling the foolish battles of ages past. We still haven't figured out that the best way to care for hungry people is to feed them, not kill them. We still haven't figured out that justice flows from mercy and mercy from truth. We still haven't figured out that truth displays itself in glory. That we're called to bring our children to the very throne of grace, and to enable them to taste and see that the Lord, He is good. Classical education is a ringing call for us to give to our children what we never had. One of the greatest truths of education is that at its heart, all true education is just repentance. We confess that we do not know everything that we ought to know. We confess that we have not done everything that we ought to have done. We confess that we have not achieved all that we ought to have achieved. We confess that we do not taste and see as we ought to taste and see. We confess that we don't hunger after the things that we ought to hunger for. We confess that we do not yet have reformed palates. And we bring that confession into the congregation, the host of the faithful. And we display for the host of the faithful our own repentance by hungering and thirsting after this rich, rich feast that ought to be ours and that will again be ours, as the gospel restores all things. Serious reading, classical methodologies, A learning that adheres to the time-honored principles of creative, visual, auditory, and tactile learning. Kind of vision for a community that weaves in the lost and the lonely, the unloved and the unlovely, the brokenhearted and the despised and the rejected, the poor. A vision that really looks for justice pouring down like the great rivers that Zechariah imagined washing the earth from the pool of Siloam, rushing down the temple steps into the uttermost parts of the earth. That's the vision of classical education. See, what we're after is not something just a little better for our kids, accelerated academics. What we're really after is a demonstration of repentance before a watching world that shows forth the wholeness of the gospel. That's why many of us are excited about going off to places like Indonesia and Iraq, and not just content with having our own little schools here. Because we see this as an opportunity to change the world. I hope you've had an opportunity to talk to some of our brothers and sisters who are here from foreign lands. They'll give you a glimpse of the frontiers that still exist in our inner cities. Now, I hope you've had an opportunity to go by and see the folks at the Servant Group International table. But because that will give you impetus for what you're doing right in your own neighborhood. And the bottom line is that all of the things that the world has dismissed are the things that God intends to be our richest feast. Intensive reading? Well, it sounds all well and good, but kids today, they just won't do it, the experts explain. Latin? Oh, well, it's a dead language, they argue. Thucydides and Bacon, Marlborough and Toynbee, why, they're just subjective narratives, they complain. Josephus and Eusebius, Methodius, Fox and Cabasalius, well, long forgotten, unimportant details, they carp. Aristotle, Pythagoras, Copernicus, Newton, Pascal, and Buonarroti, why, they're just easily surveyed and anthologized, they patronizingly remonstrate. Scott, Thackeray, Meredith, Carlyle, Burke, Johnson, and Belloc, how do they prepare a student for the job market, they query. Oh no, these old throwbacks will never do in this sophisticated environment that we now find ourselves in, they harangue. We must be realistic. But then who asked them anyway? They're the ones who got us into the current designer disaster of cultural disintegration and disarray, where all the profundities of a civilized moral order have become so much rubbish, where their systemizations and their ideologies have dismantled families right and left and seen to social disintegration, the likes of which we have not observed since the Black Death in the 14th century. If we're to buck the trend of malignant modernity, if we're going to recover our Christian inheritance, then we must begin right where we are, passing on a glorious inheritance to our children and grandchildren. We who were robbed by the Robin Hood of the Messianic state must now gather our little band of merry men together and throw off the shackles and win the day. We must return to the dumb certainties of Christendom's experience. And when we do, oh, the sights, the sounds, the feasting, the glories, the rhythms, the beauties. Holy, holy, holy. Though the darkness hide thee, though the eye of sinful man thy glory may not see, only thou art holy. There is none beside thee, perfect in power, in love, in purity. Jesus, I am resting in the joy of what thou art. I'm finding out the greatness of thy loving heart. Thou hast bid me gaze upon thee, and thy beauty fills my soul. For by thy transforming power, thou hast made me whole. And Jesus shall reign where'er the sun does his successive journeys run, his kingdom spread from shore to shore, till moons shall wax and wane no more. From north to south the princes meet to pay their homage at his feet, while western empires own their lord and savage tribes attend his word. To him shall endless prayer be made, and endless praises crown his head. His name like sweet perfume shall rise with every morning sacrifice. People in realms of every tongue dwell on his love with sweetest song, and infant voices shall proclaim their early blessings on his name. I was robbed. You probably were too. But by glory, our children and our grandchildren and our great-grandchildren and our great-great-grandchildren, for however long the Lord may tarry, shall not be. Because the gospel has called us to greater. Thanks be to God.